This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation, available at podcast.lannan.org. A.S. Byatt with Michael Silverblatt, recorded in Santa Fe on March 15, 2006. English novelist and short story writer Antonia Byatt merges realism and naturalism with the fantasies of Victorian literature. She prefers to offer fantasy not as an escape, but as an alternative to everyday life. After reading from her work, A.S. Byatt will join in conversation with Michael Silverblatt, host and producer of the premier literary talk show on radio, Bookworm.
Don't be too nice to me. I'll be here for a whole week in May, and I want you all to show me around and teach me how to be a Santa Fean. And so I want to begin by acknowledging how wonderful it is. As I understand it, there are more than 200 students attending this event, and it's really a pleasure to be able to do it. Now, and also before we start, for those of you, when you get home and you talk to the people who are envious of you, you can hear this program at Saturday at 6 p.m. on KUNM 89.9 FM, and on Sunday at 2 p.m. on KSFR 90.7 FM. And on KSFR, I guess I'm partisan because that every Sunday at 4, they air my program, Bookworm. And now this is easier for me than many things, and therefore harder, because I love the work of A.S. Byatt. There's virtually nothing that you can't talk to her about. There's nothing that she doesn't want to come to know. As she has said in story after story, to be without curiosity about the world is to be dead. And her curiosity has taken her beyond the great cycle of naturalistic, political, historical, social novels into the realm that I love most, the novels of fantasy and ambiguity and extraordinary levels of imagination. I was trying to think of how to tell you what an A.S. Byatt novel is about. And so I called her lecture agent, and I said, well, what is her new novel to be about? Now, no one has heard this list, and I have gotten permission to read it to you because she's very private about what she's working on. And this is what I heard. It was dictated to me. England and Germany from 1895 to 1918, the front in World War I, socialism, fairy tales, ceramics, the city of London, South African gold mines, puppet making, theosophy, German decadence, medical training for women, the Yellow Book, theater like Peter Pan, children in late Victorian Britain, the Victoria and Albert Museum, then known as the South Kensington Museum, suffragism, dungeonettes, neo-paganism, etc. And I can't wait. I mean, when I was in England, I had the privilege of being with a Punch and Judy troupe, and so I've done some research into puppets myself, and I can already tell you that what she knows about puppets shouldn't be known by a human being, because as you may know, Kleist wrote an essay on puppets who said that the human is at its best when it's obeying gravity, when it is puppet-like. One of the things that Byatt does, in common with those great German romanticists, is to work in philosophical opposition. So, for instance, an ice princess who has received a great gift from a suitor, a prince, of glass that looks like ice, has to learn that glass, this icy and phenomenal glass, is heated sand, and that what she thinks is her element is not, in fact, her element, is the opposite of her element. In Byatt's work, oppositions and apparent oppositions are embedded in one another, and so her forms become allomorphic. Late one night, allomorphic, let me repeat this mysterious word, I'm sorry. I don't mean for anyone ever to not understand. Two elements, two molecules that have the same elements but different structures are allomorphs. A.S. Byatt has written, her most recent works have included these four little books of stories, and I've discovered gradually, they're allomorphs of one another. They're approaches to the same subject in which the structure bends. So an ice princess in one story becomes a woman who's turning to stone in another. We watch the structure of the meaning and making of art, the human life, as art, the appearance of the unknown as being more real than the human. People who have seen a something in the woods come to suspect that this has been an impressive experience because it, this something, this loathly worm, is more real than they are. So the question of what is real, that is to say, if you begin hungrily to read books, as most of us do, we encounter a realism more profound than anything that happens when we skin our knee, although our tears in both cases are real. When we're moved by things that scar our bodies, but also there are things that dazzle and scar our minds that we never forget. And A.S. Byatt puts these two in juxtaposition, the carnal and the imaginary. It is her great power, and I ask you to welcome her.
Hello. I'm very grateful to have been invited by the Lannan Foundation, and I would have come for the privilege and pleasure of talking to Michael, if not for any other reason, because he just is the most amazing person with whom to have an ongoing conversation. I think he was saying just now it's over 10 years, in longish intervals, we've been talking to each other, and we pick up and we say, and what have you read since then? And so it goes on. And I said to him last night over dinner, when I talk to you, I feel I am actually the person I am talking, by which I mean an eccentric, literary, solitary person whose thoughts are hard to communicate, and there is a person who hears them. So I'm deeply grateful to be here this evening with him. One of the things I'm never going to do is write an autobiography. I can promise you now there will never be an autobiography. And if I can do anything to prevent a biography, there will not be a biography. I left instructions to my agents to make all attempts, legitimate and illegitimate, to stop a biography, and he was deeply horrified. But the three readings I'm going to read this evening are from fairy stories, and they are, in a sense, the autobiography. I'm going to read a bit from the story Cold in Elementals, which Michael was just talking about, in which the cold princess receives the glass presents. And then I'm going to read a longer bit from The Thing in the Forest. And then I'm going to read a very short bit from The Stone Woman. The Cold story is autobiographical because as a young woman I worried about a kind of cold place inside myself that was more interested in thinking than in human relationships. And as a fairy story reader, I had a huge sympathy with the Snow Queen, who was meant to be evil. But I liked her because she sat alone with geometry in a palace. Hans Andersen didn't like her, but I liked her. And I had this story in my mind for 12 years of an ice princess who discovered she was icy and then fell in love with fire. I'll read that bit and then tell you why the other bit's autobiographical. I was deeply moved to read that Graham Greene had said, every writer has a splinter of ice in his heart. He didn't say his or her because he wasn't young enough to be politically correct. But he might have meant his or her. The ice princess has discovered she's an ice princess, despite having been christened Fiamma Rosa. And in due course, princes come from various places bringing presents to woo her to be their wives. And the final prince sends these three gifts, which are made of glass. There is a glass hive. And I'm just going to pick up where his third envoy arrives with the third present. The third envoy arrived bloodied and incoherent. He had been set upon by bandits and had been forced to hide his package in a hollow tree from which he had retrieved it late at night. He unpacked it before the court, murmuring incoherently, "So delicate, I shall be tortured, never forgiven. Has harm come to it?" His package was in two parts, tall and cylindrical, fat and spherical. Out of the cylindrical part came a tall glass stem and a series of fine, fine glass rods, olive green, amber, white, which he built, breathing heavily, into an extraordinarily complex web of branches and twigs. It was large, the height, maybe, of a two-year-old child. Folded into his inner garments, he had a plan of the intervals of the sprouting of the branches. Fiamma Rosa was entranced. She watched each slender stem find its place, breathing quietly, staring intently. The spherical parcel proved to contain a pleroma of small spherical parcels, all nestling together, from which the envoy took a whole world of flowers, fruit, twining creepers, little birds, frost forms, and ice forms. Part of the tree he hung with buds, tight and bursting, mossy and glistening, rosy and sooty black. Then he hung blossoms of every kind, apple and cherry, magnolia and catkins, hypericum and chestnut candles. Then he added, radiating among all these, the fruits, oranges and lemons, silver pears and golden apples, rich plums and damsons, ruddy pomegranates and clustered translucent crimson berries and grapes with the bloom on them. Each tiny element was in itself an example of virtuoso glassmaking. When he had hung the flowers and the fruit, he perched the birds, a red cardinal, a white dove, a black-capped, rosy-breasted bullfinch, a blue Australian wren, an iridescent kingfisher, a bird of paradise with golden eyes in its midnight tail and a crest of flame. Then he hung winter on the remaining branches, decorating sharp black twigs with filigree leaf skeletons, flounces of snow and sharp icicles, catching the light and making rainbows in the air. The princess did not leave the tree for the rest of the day. "Look," she said to Hugh, "at the rich patterning of the colours. Look at the way the light shines in the globes of the fruit, the seeds of the pomegranate, the petals of the flowers. Look at the beetles in the clefts of the trunks like tiny jewels. Look at the feathers in the tail of the bird. What kind of a man would have made this?" I forgot to say that Hugh was her tutor, who has helped her to recognize she's an ice woman and, of course, is in love with her. "Not a prince, a craftsman," said Hugh, a little jealous. "A prince merely finds the best man and pays him. A prince at most makes the metaphor, and the craftsman carries it out." "I make my own weaving," said the princess. "I design and I weave my own work. It is possible that a prince made the glass castle, the hive, and the tree." "It is possible," said Hugh, "a prince with a taste for extravagant metaphor." Would you prefer the Northern Prince's necklace of bear's claws? Asked the Ice Woman. If you were a woman, would you? A man and his gifts are two things, said Hugh. And glass is not ice. What do you mean? Asked the princess. But Hugh would say no more. So they get to dinner, and the prince is asked to play on a long black pipe with a reed mouthpiece. I based this music, he said, looking down the table, on the songs of the goats' herds. He began to play. It was music unlike anything they had ever heard. Long, long, wavering breaths with pure notes chasing each other through them. Long calls which rose and rose, trembled and danced on the air, fell, whispered, and vanished. The princess's mind was full of water, frozen in mid-fall, or finding a narrow channel between ribs and arches of ice. When the strange piping came to an end, everyone complimented the prince on his playing. Hugh said, I have never heard such long phrases ride on one breath. I have good lungs, said Prince Sasan, glassblower's lungs. The glass is your own work, said the princess. Of course it is, said Prince Sasan. The princess said that it was very beautiful. Prince Sasan said, my country is not rich, though it is full of space, and I think it is beautiful. I cannot give you precious stones. My country is largely desert. We have an abundance only of sand, and glass blowing is one of our ancient crafts. All Sasanian princes are glass blowers. The secrets are handed on from generation to generation. I did not know glass was made from sand, said the princess. It resembles frozen water. It is sand, melted and fused, said Prince Sasan. His eyes were cast down. In a furnace of flames, said Hugh impulsively. It is melted and fused in a furnace of flames. The princess trembled slightly. Prince Sasan lifted his gaze and his black look met her blue one. There were candles between them, and she saw golden flames reflected in his dark eyes, whilst he saw white flames in her clear ones. She knew she should look away, and did not. Prince Sasan said, I have come to ask you to be my wife, and to come with me to my land of sand dunes and green sea waves and shores. Now I have seen you, He did not finish the sentence. Prince Boris said that deserts were monotonous and hot. He said he was sure the princess would prefer mountains and forests and rushing cold winds. The princess trembled a little more. Prince Sasan made a deprecating gesture with his thin hand and stared into his plate, which contained sliced peaches in red wine on a nest of crushed ice. I will come with you to the desert, said the princess. I will come with you to the desert and learn about glass blowing. I am glad of that, said Prince Sasan, for I do not know how I should have gone on if you had not. And amidst the mild uproar caused by the departure from protocol and the very real panic and fear of the king and queen and Hugo, the two of them sat and looked steadily across the table at the reflected flames in each other's eyes. Hugh gets very angry with her and tells her that Prince Sasan will melt her to a puddle of water. But she persists with the marriage, and I shall end with the end of the description of the wedding night. When the morning light came into the room, it found them curled together in a nest of red and white sheets. It revealed also marks all over the pale, cool skin. Handprints round the narrow waist, sliding impressions from delicate strokes, like wheels, raised rosy discs where his lips had rested lightly. He cried out when he saw her that he had hurt her. "No," she said. "She was part ice woman. It was her nature. She had an ice woman's skin that responded to every touch by blossoming red." Sasan still stared and repeated, "I have hurt you." "No, no," said Fiammerosa. "They are the marks of pleasure, pure pleasure. I shall cover them up, for only we ourselves should see our happiness." But inside her, a little melted pool of water slopped and swayed where she had been solid and shining. It took me about 10 years. It took me about 10 years to think about the end of that. I couldn't think how to end it. I'd created an impasse. And I did think how to end it, and I was terribly proud of my ending, which I shall not tell you in case you haven't read it. I should also say, I realized as I was reading, that the other thing that comes into all my stories is a sense that the craftsmen in the world are the important people, not princes, but people who can make things. So although it was a fairy story and it had to be a prince, he had to be someone who really knew how to construct things. The Thing in the Forest is a story about, as Michael said, about two little girls who run into a beast in a forest. The autobiographical source for this is my own sense of the disruptedness of growing up as a small child in the war. My early childhood was all lived in a country which was at war and was being bombed. And my father wasn't there. He was fighting in the Air Force in Algeria. And my mother was trying to make a kind of domestic, pleasant life for her children. And there was something happening that you didn't talk about to little children, which made everything not really as it was. And it took me a long time in my life to work out what the war had done to my mother and what it had done to me, since my father came back perfectly happily and family life resumed. This story is about evacuees. It was first published in The New Yorker, and the editor wrote and said, "Why haven't you said that it's in Britain?" And I very deliberately didn't, because I wanted it to be a fairy story, not an English story. But nevertheless, all the things in it, can be, including the beast, can be seen to be English. And probably, I'm only going to again read the beginning, but probably that's enough information. There were once two little girls who saw, or believed they saw, a thing in a forest. The two little girls were evacuees who had been sent away from the city by train with a large number of other children. They all had their names attached to their coats with safety pins, and they carried little bags or satchels and a regulation gas mask. They wore knitted scarves and bonnets or caps, and many had knitted gloves attached to long tapes which ran along their sleeves, inside their coats, and over their shoulders and out, so that they could leave their 10 woolen fingers dangling like a spare pair of hands, like a scarecrow. They all had bare legs and scuffed shoes and wrinkled socks. Most had wounds on their knees in varying stages of freshness and scabbiness. They were at the age when children fall often and their knees were unprotected. With their suitcases, some of which were almost too big to carry, and their other impedimenta, a doll, a toy car, a comic, they were like a disorderly dwarf regiment stomping along the platform. The two little girls had not met before and made friends on the train. They shared a square of chocolate and took alternate bites at an apple. One gave at the other the inside page of her Beano. Their names were Penny and Primrose.
Penny was thin and dark and taller, possibly older than Primrose, who was plump and blonde and curly. Primrose had bitten nails and a velvet collar to her dressy green coat. Penny had a bloodless, transparent paleness, a touch of blue in her fine lips. Neither of them knew where they were going, nor how long the journey might take. They did not even know why they were going, since neither of their mothers had quite known how to explain the danger to them. How do you say to your child, "I am sending you away, because enemy bombs may fall out of the sky, because the streets of the city may burn like forest fires of brick and timber, but I myself am staying here, in what I believe may be daily danger of burning, burying alive, gas, and ultimately perhaps a grey army rolling in on tanks over the suburbs or sailing its submarines up our river, all guns blazing." So the mothers, who did not resemble each other at all, behaved alike and explained nothing. It was easier. Their daughters, they knew, were little girls who would not be able to understand or imagine. The girls discussed on the train whether it was a sort of holiday or a sort of punishment, or a bit of both. Penny had read a book about Boy Scouts, but the children on the train did not appear to be brownies or wolf cubs, only a mongrel battalion of the lost. Both little girls had the idea that these were all perhaps not very good children, possibly being sent away for that reason. They were pleased to be able to define each other as nice. They would stick together, they agreed, try to sit together and things. The train crawled sluggishly further and further away from the city and their homes. It was not a clean train. The upholstery of their carriage had the dank smell of unwashed trousers, and the gusts of hot steam rolling backwards past their windows were full of specks of flimsy ash and sharp grit and occasional fiery sparks that pricked face and fingers like hot needles if you opened the window. The window panes were both grimy and misted up. The train stopped frequently, and when it stopped, they used their gloves to wipe rounds through which they peered out at flooded fields, furrowed hillsides, and tiny stations whose names were carefully blacked out, whose platforms were empty of life. The children did not know that the namelessness was meant to baffle or delude an invading army. They felt, they did not think it out, but somewhere inside them, the idea sprouted that the erasure was because of them, because they were not meant to know where they were going, or, like Hansel and Gretel, to find the way back. They did not speak to each other of this anxiety, but began the kind of conversation children have about things they really disliked, things that upset or disgusted or frightened them. Semolina pudding with its grainy texture, mushy peas, fat on roast meat, listening to the stairs and the window sashes creaking in the dark or the wind, gangs in playgrounds. They felt the pressure of all the other alien children in all the other carriages as a potential gang. They shared another square of chocolate and licked their fingers and looked out at a great white goose flapping its wings beside an inky pond. The sky grew dark grey, and in the end, the train halted. The children got out and lined up in a crocodile and were led to a mud-coloured bus. They were billeted temporarily in a mansion commandeered from its owner, which was to be arranged to hold a hospital for the long-term disabled and a secret store of artworks and other valuables. The children were told they were there temporarily until families were found to take them into their homes. Penny and Primrose held hands and said to each other that it would be wizard if they could go to the same family because at least they would have each other. They didn't say anything at all to the rather tired-looking ladies who were ordering them about because with the cunning of little children, they knew that requests were most often counterproductive. Adults liked saying no. They imagined possible families into which they might be thrust. They did not discuss what they imagined, as these pictures, like the black station signs, were too frightening, and words might make some horror solid in some magical way. Penny, who was a reading child, imagined Victorian dark pillars of severity, like Jane Eyre's Mr. Brocklehurst or David Copperfield's Mr. Murdstone. Primrose imagined, she didn't know why, a fat woman with a white cap and round red arms who smiled nicely but made the children wear sacking aprons and scrub the steps and the stove. "It's like we were orphans," she said to Penny. "But we're not," Penny said, "if we manage to stick together." The great house had a double flight of imposing stairs to its front door, and carved griffins and unicorns on its balustrade. There was no lighting because of the blackout. All the windows were shuttered. No welcoming brightness leaked across door or windowsill. The children trudged up the staircase in their crocodile, hung their coats on a numbered makeshift hook, and were given supper, Irish stew and rice pudding with a dollop of blood-red jam, before going to bed in long makeshift dormitories where once servants had slept. They had camp beds, military issue, and grey shoddy blankets. Penny and Primrose got beds together, but couldn't get a corner. When daylight came, things seemed as they mostly do, brighter and better. The children were given breakfast in a large vaulted room. They sat at trestle tables, eating porridge made with water and a dab of the red jam, heavy cups of strong tea. Then they were told they could go out and play until lunchtime. Children in those days, wherever they came from, were not closely watched, were allowed to come and go freely, and those evacuated children were not herded into any kind of holding pen or transit camp. They were told they should be back for lunch at 12:30, by which time those in charge hoped to have sorted out their provisional future lives. It was not known how they would know when it was 12:30, but it was expected that, despite the fact that few of them had wristwatches, they would know how to keep an eye on the time. It was what they were used to. Penny and Primrose went out together in their respectable coats and lace shoes onto the terrace. The terrace appeared to them to be vast, and was indeed extensive. Beyond it was a stone balustrade with a staircase leading down to a lawn, which that moment had a quicksilver sheen on the lengthening grass. It was flanked by long flower beds full of overblown annuals and damp clumps of stalks. A gardener would have noticed the beginnings of neglect, but these were urban little girls, and they noticed the jungly mass of wet stems and the vegetable smell. Across the lawn, which seemed considerably vaster than the vast terrace, was a sculpted yew hedge with many twigs and shoots out of place. In the middle of the hedge was a wicket gate, and beyond the gate were trees, woodland, a forest, the little girls said to themselves. "Let's go into the forest," said Penny, as though the sentence was required of her. Primrose hesitated. Most of the other children were running up and down the terrace, scuffing their shoes in the gravel. Some boys were kicking a ball on the grass. The sun came right out, full from behind a hazy cloud, and the trees suddenly looked both gleaming and secret. "Okay," said Primrose. "We needn't go far." "No, I've never been in a forest." "Nor me." "We ought to look at it while we've got the opportunity," said Penny. There was a very small child, one of the smallest, whose name, she told everyone, was Alice, with a Y, she told those who could spell, and those who couldn't, which surely included herself. She was barely out of nappies. She was quite extraordinarily pretty, pink and white, with large pale blue eyes and sparse little golden curls over her head, all over her head and neck, through which her pink skin could be seen. Nobody seemed to be in charge of her, no elder brother or sister. She had not quite managed to wash the tear stains from her dimpled cheeks. She had made several attempts to attach herself to Penny and Primrose. They did not want her. They were excited about meeting and liking each other. She said, "Now, I'm coming too into the forest." "No, you aren't," said Primrose. "You're too little. You must stay here," said Penny. "You'll get lost," said Primrose. "You won't get lost. I'll come with you," said the little creature, with an engaging smile made for loving parents and grandparents. "We don't want you, you see," said Primrose. "It's for your own good," said Penny. Alice went on smiling hopefully, the smile becoming more of a mask. "It will be all right," said Alice. "Run," said Primrose. They ran. They ran down the steps and across the lawn and through the gate into the forest. They didn't look back. They were long-legged little girls, not toddlers. The trees were silent round them, holding out their branches to the sun, breathing noiselessly. Primrose touched the warm skin of the nearest saplings, taking off her gloves to feel their cracks and knots. There were no obvious paths. Dark and light came and went, inviting and mysterious, as the wind pushed clouds across the face of the sun. "We have to be careful not to get lost," she said. "In stories, people make marks on tree trunks, or unroll a thread, or leave a trail of white pebbles to find their way back." "We needn't go out of sight of the gate," said Primrose. "We could just explore a little bit." They set off very slowly. They went on tiptoe, making their own narrow passages through the undergrowth, which sometimes came as high as their thin shoulders. They were urban and unaccustomed to silence. At first, the absence of human noise filled them with a kind of awe, as though, while they would not have put it to themselves in this way, they had got to some original place from which they or those before them had come, and which they therefore recognized. Then they began to hear the small sounds that were there, the chatter and repeated lilt and alarm of invisible birds high up further in, the hum and buzz of insects, rustling in dry leaves, rushes of movement in thickets, slitherings, dry coughs, sharp cracks. They went on, pointing out to each other creepers draped with glistening berries, crimson, black, and emerald, little crops of toadstools, some scarlet, some ghostly pale, some a dead flesh purple, some like tiny parasols, and some like pieces of meat protruding from tree trunks. Did they hear it first or smell it first? Both sound and scent were at first infinitesimal and dispersed. Both gave the strange impression of moving in waves, from the whole perimeter of the forest. Both increased very slowly in volume, and both were mixed, a sound and a smell fabricated of many disparate sounds and smells. A crunching, a crackling, a crushing, a heavy thumping, combined with threshing and thrashing, and added to that a gulping, heaving, boiling, bursting, steaming sound, full of bubbles and farts, piffs and explosions, swallowings and wallowings. The smell was worse and more aggressive than the sound. It was a liquid smell of putrefaction, the smell of maggoty things at the bottom of untended dustbins, the smell of blocked drains and unwashed trousers, mixed with the smell of bad eggs and of rotten carpets and ancient polluted bedding. The new ordinary forest smells and sounds of leaves and humus, fur and feathers, so to speak, went out like lights as the atmosphere of the thing preceded it. The two little girls looked at each other and took each other's hand. Speechlessly and instinctively, they crouched down behind a fallen tree trunk and trembled as the thing came into view. Its head appeared to form or become first visible in the distance between the trees. Its face, which was triangular, appeared like a rubbery or fleshy mask over a shapeless sprouting bulb of a head, like a monstrous turnip. Its colour was the colour of flayed flesh, pitted with wormholes, and its expression was neither wrath nor greed, but pure misery. Its most defined feature was a vast mouth, pulled down and down at the corners, tight with a kind of pain. Its lips were thin and raised like welts from whip strokes. It had blind, opaque white eyes, fringed with fleshy lashes and brows, like the feelers of sea anemones. Its face was close to the ground and moved towards the children between its forearms, which were squat, thick, powerful, and akimbo, like a cross between a monstrous washerwoman and a primeval dragon. The flesh on these forearms was glistening and mottled, every colour, from the green of mould to the red-brown of raw liver to the dirty white of dry rot. The rest of its very large body appeared to be glued together like still-wet papier-mâché or the carapace of stones and straws and twigs worn by caddis flies underwater. It had a tubular shape, as a turd has a tubular shape, a provisional amalgam. It was made of rank meat and decaying vegetation, but it also trailed veils and prostheses of man-made materials, bits of wire netting, foul dishcloths, wire wool full of pan scrubbings, rusty nuts and bolts. It had feeble stubs and stumps of very slender legs, growing out of it at all angles, wavering and rippling like the suckered feet of a caterpillar or the squirming fringe of a centipede. On and on it came, bending and crushing whatever lay in its path, including bushes, though not substantial trees, which it wound between awkwardly. The little girls observed with horrified fascination that when it met a sharp stone or a narrow tree trunk, it allowed itself to be sliced through, flowed sluggishly round in two or three smaller worms, convulsed and reunited. Its progress was achingly slow, very smelly, and apparently very painful, for it moaned and whined amongst its other burblings and belchings. They thought it could not see, or certainly could not see clearly. It and its stench passed within a few feet of their tree trunk, humping along, leaving behind it a trail of bloody slime and dead foliage, sucked to dry skeletons. Its end was flat and blunt, almost transparent, like some earthworms. When it had gone, Penny and Primrose, kneeling on the moss and dead leaves, put their arms about each other and hugged each other, shaking with dry sobs. Then they stood up, still silent, and stared together hand in hand at the trail of obliteration and destruction, which wound out of the forest and into it again. They went back, hand in hand, without looking behind them, afraid that the wicket gate, the lawn, the stone steps, the balustrade, the terrace and the great house would be transmogrified or simply not there. But the boys were still playing football on the lawn. A group of girls were skipping and singing shrilly on the gravel. They let go each other's hands and went back in. They did not speak to each other again. I've been splendidly frugal with my time. I always worry about sort of reading too much, and so I end up reading too little. I'll read you a bit now of A Stone Woman, which is actually also in this book. And I will tell you what originally caused me to write it. It is to do with my having, between one perfectly ordinary day and the next, very nearly died and had to rush into hospital and have a large part of my internal gut, which had gone gangrenous, cut out. And when I recovered from this operation, I had this incredibly cheerful surgeon called Mr. Wellwood, after whom I have named the hero of my next novel, which I'm still writing. And he came and he said, "Well," he said, "I thought you had about 4 days to live. And I see I was wrong, you had about 4 hours." and tapped me on the stomach, which was and has remained without sensation. And when I saw I was still alive and really perfectly all right, I became very cheerful because I felt I have survived, I have survived. And I kept tapping this dead place which remained dead. And I thought, this is great, I am dead and I am alive. And I had this vision in my head of a woman who very, very slowly turns to stone. And she turns not, as it were, into a block of granite, but into an incredible amalgam of every particular kind of stone there is, all sort of growing in sort of excrescences out of her body, jewel stones and sort of a string of opals round her neck and sort of clumping things sprouting out of her knees. And she takes this remarkably placidly, as I, in fact, took, having lost the sensation in my gut. It's also partly a metaphor for grief, because she's a woman who has lived alone with her mother who has just died. And it's a metaphor for the kind of silence of grief. And as she gets day by day more to be stony, she begins to think, well, in the end, I am simply going to be a stone. And I had better find somewhere to go. It never occurs to her to call in a doctor because this is too absurd. She sees it something she's living through. So she decides to go to a very large cemetery because she thinks that when the time comes when she sees she's completely stone and can't move anymore, she can stand among the stone angels in the cemetery and just quietly become covered with moss and have the rain falling on her. And actually this won't be too bad, though she does worry about what it will feel like to be still alive inside something that can't move. So, and then when she gets to the cemetery, I'll read a bit because I have time, she finds to her horror that the stone angels in the cemetery have never been alive. It came to her that in such a place, amongst weeping angels and grieving cherubs, she might find a quiet resting place. So she set out on foot, hooded and booted, with her new indefatigable rolling pace, marble joint in marble socket. It was a grey day at the end of winter. She strode in through a wrought iron gate in a high wall. What she saw was a flat, stony city, house after house under the humped ripples of earth, marked by flat stones, standing stones, canted stones, fallen stones, soot-stained, dropping stains, scum-stained, crumbled, carved, repeating, repeating. She walked along its silent pathways past dripping yews and leafless birches and speckled laurels, looking for stone women. They stood there, or occasionally lay fallen there, on the rich earth. There were many of them, but they resembled each other with more than a family resemblance. There were the sweetly regretful lady angels, one arm pointing upwards, one turned down to scatter an arrested fall of stony flowers. There were the chubby child angels, wearing simple embroidered stone tunics over chubby stone knees, also holding drooping flowers. Some busy monumental mason had turned them out to order, one after the other, their sweetly arched lips or apple cheeks, well-practiced tricks of the trade. There was no other living person in that place, though there was a great deal of energetic organic life, long snaking brambles thrust between the stones for a place in the light. Tombstones and angels alike wore bushy coats of gripping ivy, shining in the wind and the wet as the leaves moved, very slightly. So she takes against the stone ladies who have never been alive before they became stone, and walks round a corner and comes upon a stonemason mending things who turns out to be an Icelander and is sculpting a rather too lifelike image of a dead child, which she immediately sees has lived and is dead, unlike the monuments. So she stops to look at it, and he gives her a little present. The thing I should say to you is that I knew all along that the subject of this story was not death, but the terrible energy of people who have reached the age I have reached and are approaching death, quite obviously. There's not so much time left, and I try to write faster and faster because I might get stopped, and after the operation I was quite sure I might get stopped at any minute. But the story, in some curious way, is about energy, although she's turning to stone. Anyway, she talks to the Icelander, who says, who talks about the stones he's been changing. I'm not supposed, he said, to appropriate things which belong here, but I take the lost ones, the detached ones without a fixed place. I look for the life in them. Ah, Pygmalion. Hardly. You like them. Like is the wrong word. They are alive. He laughed. Stones are alive where I come from. Where? She breathed. I am an Icelander. I work here in the winter and go home in the summer when nights are bright. And then he gives her a small stone and she goes home. And this is my final bit of reading. It took me almost as long to think this up as it took me to think up the end of the other story. This is only the middle of this one. That evening, she understood she might have been wrong about her immediate fate. She put the stone hand he had given her on her desk and went into the kitchen to make herself bread and cheese. She was trembling with exertion and emotion, with fear of stony enclosure and complicated anxiety about the Icelander. The bread knife slipped as she struggled to cut the soft loaf and sliced into her stone hand between finger and thumb. She felt pain, which surprised her, and the spurt of hot blood from the wound, whose depth she could not gauge. She watched the thick red liquid run down the back of her hand, onto the bread, onto the table. It was ruddy gold, running in long, glassy strings, and where it touched the bread went up in smoke. And where it touched the table, it hissed and smoked and bored its hot way through the wood and dripped, a duller red now, onto the plastic floor, which it singed with amber circles and puckering. Her veins were full of molten lava. She put out the tiny fires and threw away the burnt bread. She thought, I am not going to stand in the rain and grow moss. I may erupt. I do not know how that will be. She stood with the bread knife in her hand and considered the rough stripes her blood had seared into the steel. She felt panic. To become stone is a figure, however fantastic, for death. But to become molten lava and to contain a furnace? Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
You know, Scheherazade stopped her stories midway to maintain her life for the next night of storytelling, but those of us who can't bear to have stories end without being completed will want to know that the two books from which Antonia Byatt read are Elementals and Little Black Book of Stories. And they're marvelous. You won't just want to read the end or middles or beginnings of these, but all of them. Now, surely what we heard is language overtaking the ordinary elements of fairy stories to create a stink in the woods so ripe that I heard some of you say, ugh. And I wanted to begin by talking to you about how you gained the confidence as a writer to make words visceral in that manner.
I think, the thing I've most loved all my life is complicated language. It took me a long time as a writer to get out of the genteel tone of the English lady's novel. And there are very good and high examples of that, like Elizabeth Bowen. And she has a vocabulary which is much more restricted, and she does things very quietly. And it took me a long time to realize it wasn't my nature to go along in a quiet and understated manner. I can do that if I want to. But I discovered I didn't want to because I loved the language so much, and I wanted to use all of it. I had terrible trouble with the Stone Woman story because I bought myself an encyclopedia of stones. I bought myself the LaRousse Encyclopedia of Stones, and I said gloomily to my editor, I kept holding up the beautiful words that attach to each of these stones, and I couldn't decide which to cut, and I'm sorry, but I haven't cut them. Every reviewer will say there are too many words in this book, but I love them, and it's like sort of having a collection of extraordinary objects. You hold them up to the light. I can cut. But in that case, I felt they were also the right thing for that book. It should have been encrusted with stone words. And if it wasn't, there was something wrong with it. So I left it. And the reviewers duly said too many nouns. I think something I learned as a girl at school doing Paradise Lost, which I thought I was going to hate. Didn't think I wanted to study an epic about the Garden of Eden. And when I discovered the way Milton was able to use the Latin vocabulary of English and play it off against the Anglo-Saxon Germanic vocabulary of English, that was part of the time when I became a writer. I thought, I must do this.
Well, I remember very vividly Hugh Kenner pointing out how... let me stop for a second. Hugh Kenner, one of the great English critics, born in Canada. The Pound Era, one of the great works of literary criticism. Elizabeth Bowen, the author of a book so perfect called The Death of the Heart, that I recommend it to you all. And then at the end, she wrote a book so weird called Eva Trout.
That was good, too.
Fabulous. But Kenner would point out, yes, every time we speak, we indicate how one language infiltrates another. To be or not to be. Harsh English, monosyllabic, Anglo-Saxon. That is the question. Latin. And, when a writer is writing, the consciousness that, yes, the word that introduces confusion is the word that comes from the invading country.
Yeah.
That's what we learn. And then we adopt these words into our language, and every sentence is the history of language. And one of the things you find again and again in Antonia Byatt's stories, a woman thinks of herself as redundantly afloat in an airplane, but then she thinks, well, that's how Milton describes the serpent. We're always being reminded that language gives us a story. And the characters think in terms of those stories because the characters are people who love to read. They're greedy readers. Now, I wanted to talk to you about that because it seems to me always that what we just heard is not what people call you. People say cerebral, and they say doll inside Russian doll. This is not untrue, but the language is so vivid, and it wants to tell you how it came to be vivid through a history of reading, mm-hmm, that is not foreign to the work, but revealed within the work. Like me, you care for the reader to learn about reading.
I am slightly baffled by the idea that writers shouldn't read. I've often found, you know, if I go to talk to groups of writers, somebody always asks the question, why do you read so much? You must be losing your originality. And in fact, exactly the opposite happens. You gain originality by listening to so many voices that you can see what it is, which of the voices you've listened to that you need when you want to say something. And indeed, you only understand, at least I only understand what is happening to me because I have the language to understand it with. And that includes understanding that the body understands things that you can't put into words, but you can utter that sentence, which is a paradox. And I think, actually, very bodily. I get the words quite late, so I'm not simply cerebral. And I respect words. And the other thing, you know, we've gone through a kind of period of literary criticism in which it was fashionable to say that language is inadequate, that language cannot describe the world outside us. My view is that, A, that's meaningless because you could only think with language, and you could only say with language that language can't describe the world. And also, language is quite incredibly adequate to most of our human experience. I'm sure there are things out there in the universe that we know nothing about and can't describe because we don't know they're there. But anything we know anything about, we will make words. That is the nature of this animal. It is a language animal. I suppose that is what I am. I am a language animal, both sides of that. I am, which is fun. I think that came to me very late. I had to be quite sure I could do it before it wasn't terrifying. And you would read other people's beautiful sentences and feel defeated.
What I love, you know, I'm going to get this wrong. Pope tells us in his translation of the Odyssey, when Priam labors some great stone to throw, the words move heavy and the line moves slow. And so when we hear this creature coming through the darkness in The Thing in the Forest, we're watching everything language knows about alliteration, about how to slither, about how to slide, about how to roll over. And the vowels become short as the creature moves more quickly. The vowels are long as the creature lumbers through a hedge. How does poetry and cadence enter your composition?
It's in my head. I have an extremely retentive memory. And as a child and even as an undergraduate, I never wrote essays on novels, only on poetry, because you can study poetry very rigorously. And also you can learn enough of it by heart to do an exam paper. I never saw how you could answer an exam question on George Eliot or Tolstoy, because the language matters so much. It's very hard to make a linguistic map of either of them that will go into an exam question, where you have some hope with the ode on a Grecian urn. It is that simple, but also, of course, it makes you linguistically very, very aware if you read a lot of poetry very young. And I was one of those people, it just went into my head, you know, and I would read a page and I knew it by heart. And I haven't got that now. And what I'm doing now in order to keep that kind of very close attention alive is reading things in German in bed at night at 1 a.m. with a dictionary, because that makes me look at every word. And because my German isn't that good, some curious way, it's exercising the same bit of my brain as learning poetry.
Now, one of the things that you learned when you were in school is that there is a different way that women are taught than men. and you were told by a woman teacher that everyone wants to write a novel, but you can't do it, you won't be any good. You were taught by the male teachers that if you got married, that your grant would be taken away, whereas if men got married, they were given larger grants because they were going to have a larger family. Now, I notice in the understructure, and I only noticed it tonight, that there is in this title, Little Black Book of Stories, a dark male underside. The little black book is where men keep the numbers of those girls they keep secret from their wives or their girlfriends. And I wanted to ask you about that fearsome underlayer in which a woman is forced to toil, aware that there's a little black book where the cards are stacked against her.
That did happen to me when I was a postgraduate. It wasn't something that might happen. It did happen. My grant got taken away because I got married. And I was told by the authorities that the men who got married would have their grants increased because they would need more money because they had to support a wife. This was the late 1950s. And like many peculiar things, it was actually a release because I thought, right, I can give up being a postgraduate and write a book. But I didn't think it with that degree of courage. And I remember as a schoolgirl thinking, I don't want to be a woman in a house, and I don't want to be an unmarried woman teacher in a college, really. And I do want to be able to choose. I mean, the men with a little black book of other women didn't bother me because what I wanted was my independence. And I thought, I still feel very unhappy when I remember this sense that anything I organized myself to want to do, I probably wasn't by the system going to be allowed to do. Unfortunately, I mean, or fortunately, I was just compulsively driven to go on. But I think it's probably still so to a certain extent. Having said that, I haven't found feminist theory and the sort of strong body of feminist thought all that supportive, because I feel that's in some curious way another system that is trying to absorb me into certain attitudes and certain social behaviors, which are not to do with my gut reaction to the English language and my need to write books by myself, not for a cause. I am not a person who has done things for a cause. I am a woman who was humiliated by how she found herself as a student when the men were not humiliated. You know, and people would say to you, you have to be twice as good, you know, as a woman to be at Cambridge. And you would say, yes, but, you know, where will I end up? And the men could at least think out where they would end up on what the English persist in calling a level playing field.
Well, you've landed on your feet, I notice.
Yes. Yes, yes. I mean, it's all come out perfectly all right, but it could have not. And the other thing was, you know, when I wrote my first novel, I didn't want to write about that. But that was all I had got to write about. That was the only thing I knew when I began writing this novel when I was about 18. I knew about being a woman that had two forking paths, the kitchen and sex and children, or solitude and the cerebral, which is why I suppose I take such cerebral pleasure in the totally fleshly. It's a kind of victory. And my stone woman is much more fleshly than my anxious girls going to bed with people when they weren't sure they wanted to do in other books.
Those passages are thrilling because one senses in books like The Virgin in the Garden that the writer is holding her breath and saying, okay, I will tell what it's like to sleep with someone you don't necessarily want to sleep with, even if the sex is good. I am going to do this to a T. I am going to do it unmodulated, and I will be as soon as you turn the next page, even smarter than I had been on the page before.
Well, that's my Puritan upbringing. I was taught always, you must do a thing as well as you can, and you mustn't stop. Sex or writing. I did have a very puritanical upbringing. I also felt and feel, but I'm not coming from a lot of shocking writers' directions, I feel you ought to be able to write about anything you know, which is quite different from the feeling that writing ought to shock people or it's failed. I feel you should be able to go on and say, as you say, precisely what it feels like. And my heroine, Frederica, in The Virgin in the Garden, was an unfortunate kind of woman who likes sex with a man that she doesn't actually want to live with, and knows she ought to want to live with men that she actually doesn't want to sleep with. And anyway, she wants to be on her own and think. So that's a muddle. And there is no way out. She does all right at the end, because at the end of the fourth book, I felt she might have learnt enough to pick a man that was useful in both ways. And because of my passion for craftsmen and non-literary people, he turns out to be a scientist. But then, of course, what I tend to do is put my women in these very modern marriages where you're two countries apart and have to take an aeroplane to get to the bed in which you will have the good sex. Which actually, I think, for some reason, I like these modern marriages where people are separate and together. I feel it works. At the same time, I can observe that it's extremely stressful. But I don't think there's any modern kind of way of living that isn't extremely stressful. And it's better than being bored. Honestly, my generation was bored to death most of the time. It was bored by the war when it wasn't frightened. It was bored by rationing. It was bored by all the rules about how it ought to behave. It was bored because there was no television. And it sat at home and it thought, bedtime, and tomorrow I shall be bored again. And at least, I mean, it's your own fault now, if you're bored. There is such a variety of things in the world that you could do. It's all right, if you're depressed, that's different, but you don't have to be bored.
Among the choices in this garden of forking paths that have come into your work is a growing and paired interest in the natural sciences and in fairy stories. Now, one of the places that I first know that the two are paired is, in fact, in one of the great entomologists of literature, a Frenchman named Henri Fabre. And he, in addition to writing very great books, like The Life of the Spider, and he has books on termites that will turn you into a weeping pulp. There was a point...
Wasp.
Yes,
yes. It lays its eggs in other people.
Yeah. But he wrote as well for children, and what he does in one of his books, one of his essays on the spider for children, is he tells the whole story of Cinderella in as great detail as Perrault tells it, and greater, and says, "But oh, my child, not rags to gown or pumpkin to coach can equal the thrill and the interest of the web of the spider." And he goes on to tell you how, if you reach a finger under its belly, you will feel the spot of dew on that belly that facilitates the thread to extrude. And that understanding that metamorphosis is a subject in fairy literature as deeply as it is in natural science seems to me to be very deeply your subject as well, the metamorphic.
Every time I talk to you, you tell me something that's true and that I didn't know. And that there is nobody else in the world on whom I can rely to tell me something. I mean, I'm It is perfectly true, and I'm so taken aback that I hadn't quite thought of it in that shape. Take me a minute or two to get round it. And you've even done it with the sort of totally solid image of the web of the spider, which belongs both in fairy stories and in... What is left out is what we think of that equation, is what we think of as social realism, you know, about people thinking about their little social movements or... There are two words I never use, and one of them is relationships. And you would think novels are about relationships, but actually relationships become interesting at the point where they become like spiders. They, partly because they tend to resemble each other too much in most novels. And I find them more interesting if you make them strange. Science always makes things strange. You know, you think you've seen a spider's web and then you know you don't know it. And fairy stories make things strange. They tell you shapes in your life, inexorable shapes, that you always knew because you were told these things very young. And people can't bend or break or recreate a fairy story. There are certain shapes it has to be, even though there are endless variations on those shapes. You can't... There was a sort of series of feminist attempts to retell them, to make the passive princess into an active heroine. And these people never bothered to go and look at the Brothers Grimm, in which there are lots of extremely active and violent princesses who are much stronger than the men, and there is a pattern already there. You don't have to go reversing one in that kind of story. But it's the sense of... It's partly mystery. It's mystery and order. The combination of an order beyond human apprehension and one's apprehension that this is mysterious that bring the two together. Yes?
Yes.
And that's why I spend my time reading science, because just like you, it tells me things I didn't know. And it tells me with a kind of order which you have to put your mind to learning. And if you get interested in fairy stories as opposed to just listening to them as a child and them sweeping over you, you see they represent something about language and about human nature, which I've never seen a completely adequate account of. But anyone who decides, who is the person who is, oh, it's Abu Ben, no, it isn't. Who is the person who is asked whether they would rather live or make works of art? It's my favorite quote from Yeats. A man must choose perfection of the life or of the work. And then he says if he chooses the latter, he's condemned. And I always knew really I was a chooser of perfection of the work. And you feel that scientists are too. They have to get it right. And they have to get what they're doing right, not who they are right. And you feel that something like that is at the root of the inexorability of the fairy story.
Oh, that's beautiful. There's a sentence I was telling Antonia earlier that I'll never forget. Paul Goodman was visiting a planetarium, a teacher of astronomers, and he was impressed by the seriousness of the students, Paul Goodman was, and said to the teacher, the head astronomer, "Well, you seem to have marvelous students." And the astronomer said, "They are expert diagnosticians and statisticians, but they will never be astronomers because they do not love the stars."
That's and where they meet, too.
That's yeah. Where they meet, it seems to me, that moment of passion to get the words right. You know, as I sit there listening to you read, and you're, by the way, a wonderful reader, you could tell me any bedtime story. hearing the words gotten right or the contraction of the phrases of a sentence until the sentence hits a point. The knowledge that it is not just the craft, but that the craft has to engage with love in the subject.
Yeah. And it has to engage with truthfulness. And I haven't sorted out what the truthfulness of fiction is, but that's why I so love writing about craftsmen and indeed, by extension, scientists. And they've
kept
me
safe. What do you mean about the monster, the thing in the forest, being more real than the girls?
There's a scene in another story of mine called The Djinn in the Nightingale's Eye about a woman professor of a certain age who is a narratologist, and she goes to Turkey where she finds a very large djinn in her bed, or genie. I had trouble with publishers because they won't let me use Rudyard Kipling's spelling of djinn, and I can't see it with any other. D-J-I-N-N it is. And modern Arabists tell me I've got it wrong. The current spelling they say is J-I-N-N, and I say I learnt it from Rudyard Kipling. Anyway, she finds herself at one point face-to-face with the statue of Diana of Ephesus, who is the sort of goddess with all the innumerable breasts in her sacred place in Ephesus. And she suddenly realizes, which actually happened to me, that this statue, which is clearly not alive, of a goddess who is no longer worshipped, nevertheless has been more real to more human beings over long periods of time in more places than she herself will ever be. You know, she is a living, breathing human being who will soon be dead. That goddess has never breathed, but she's been much more alive to so many more people. The life of her is in the world and continues in the world. And the statue has the sort of aura of that life round it. And I think in the same way, the beast in the forest, which is, as I said, telling the truth, made up of my mother's terror of being shut in a kitchen in the war. I mean, that's why it has all these stinking things attached to it. My mother was a demented graduate in English who didn't want to be in a kitchen. And she was not only in a kitchen, she was in a kitchen in a war. So she had no husband and nothing to cook, but she had to go on cooking. And she was totally disappointed. And the thing is that, but because it's also the loathly worm and the lely worm of northern mythology, and only northern English worms have that capacity to slice themselves and mend again. I got it all sort of right. I invented it, but it does what it ought to do, being in a northern English wood. That, too, has been so much used to the imaginations of so many people that although I have added bits of myself and my mother to it, it is more real than myself and my mother in the context of thinking about worms, using the German word Wurm. And that makes me happy. You like there to be things in the world that were there before you and will be there after you that mean something. You don't want it to be only self-centered, or you'll be absolutely terrified of dying, I think.
That the world would cease to exist when you leave it.
Yes, you need to think that there are things that go on, and I like there to be stories that go on. And I think there are people have written novels which became, take The Great Gatsby, which is to me simply a fairy tale in the sense that it has that quality of being more real than I am, although it's totally unreal. It's an extraordinary thing. And the number of people who take quotes from Gatsby and incorporate them into their own writing because they can't do without them somehow gives it the that status of a thing like Diana of Ephesus. It is.
Sometimes I think that language can be brought to such a pitch of life that the page I'm reading is more alive than I am.
Yeah. Which is, of course, because I remember getting into a terrible rage with Iris Murdoch because she never knew, because she was using the myth of Marsyas and I was using it in a minor way in a corner of something I was writing. And I thought, you know, oh, bother. You know, there's Iris doing something brilliant with the myth of... And I thought, no, wait. She needs me to be thinking about Marsyas and to know about Marsyas for her writing to have the power it has. Marsyas has to be more alive than Iris's account of it, and she's depending on him being more alive. And therefore, my version is a part of another part of the same thing. And this makes you see that originality is a minor thing in writing. The important thing is to do it well and make it part of all the things that already are.
So in other words, the ongoing invocation of the already alive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Dantica, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcast and the audio archives.